my name is Misty and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Books of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual, in our personal stories, describe in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker. And we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them, and I must have this thing. With 36 and a half years of sobriety, she has got a story to tell, and I'm so excited to hear what she has to say. Welcome, Ms. Karen S. From the Alfresco Women's Meeting.
I'm Karen. I'm an alcoholic and addict. It's going to be a little difficult today. I've been very blue all day. There's an outside issue that is weighing heavily on my heart, and I have to say that, and because of that, I had to bring my higher power in here with me because it's an outside issue, but it makes me kind of sad. Not kind of sad, very sad. But I feel like what it does is it trivializes my importance and to the world. I feel like it makes me less significant as a person, which is probably a good thing, make me a little bit humble. But what it does is it makes me realize that I'm here for service, and I'm here because I'm hoping that something I say tonight may touch somebody in here, may help somebody in here, and may let you know that there is a way, and the way is Alcoholics Anonymous. The way to live in recovery is to embrace sobriety and embrace this program, and through it, I've been able to maintain my 36 and a half years. My sobriety date is December 15th, 1986, back in the 80s, when we all had big hair and shoulder pads, and we had beepers, and we had flip phones. We had big book ones. But it was, that's when I got sober. I had had enough of using, and what I like to do when I tell my story is spend a little bit of time on what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And because at this point, I am sober more than twice as long as I was drunk, because I got started at age 15, and I ended right before my 34th birthday, and I am a little over 70 right now, and so I've been here a long time. So a lot of my story is about recovery and how I live my life in recovery. And what I do in recovery, there's a couple of things that drive my recovery. Number one is I seek acceptance as much as I can. I mind my own business as much as I can. I've learned how to set really good and clear boundaries with people in a nice way. And I don't take myself too seriously, I think is an important thing too. So that's what I do to drive my recovery. And I have a lot of wonderful things in my life, and I've gone through a lot of difficult things in my life, but I've not had to take a drink since that day. So I'm very, very grateful for that. Gratitude is the other thing that drives my sobriety. Did I say that? Anyway, so what it was like. I was a very anxious young child. I had a lot of anxiety. I grew up in a home that had a lot of rigidity. My parents, I left my water there. Thank you. It's my husband. Thank you. My parents are both not alcoholics. A lot of people come from long lines of alcoholism. I come from a long line of mental illness, sickness, and disease. But my parents were not alcoholics, but my mother was very, very rigid and very difficult. And I had a really tough relationship with her. She was abandoned by her father when she was six. She was placed in an orphanage as a ward of the state. My grandmother was all of 24 years old, and she had a nervous breakdown back in those days. That's what they called it. And so my mother got her attention by being perfect. And so when she came back to life and she became my mother back in those days,
everything had to be absolutely perfect. And I mean, she would come in the morning, inspect my room. If this piping on the bedspread was not perfect, it got pulled down and I had to do it again. And I walked on eggshells, you know, like my whole life. And then my father was complicit in, let's keep the storm down. So whenever, you know, because my mother would rage, she was also a rageaholic. So whenever he would help her to keep everything down, and so he was her, you know, he was her co-conspirator, I guess, in raising me. So I was this really anxious child, and big deal. What I developed was the need to be able to be a people pleaser. So I was really good at that for a long time. And so I had my first drink when I was 13 at a wedding, and I remember tasting it. It was really warm. It felt really good. I didn't get drunk, but I liked the feeling. It was the first time I felt a little bit just calm from what I did. And then a year later, at actually 2 years later, I went to another wedding and I got shit faced drunk. You know, and they all thought it was funny, like this little 15-year-old girl drunk up her ass, you know, in a mini skirt with, you know, back at the wedding. And I remember looking up at my father saying, "Now I know how you feel." And I don't know why I said that, because he wasn't really an alcoholic, although there were times when he overdrank. So I started, that was what happened, and then I was off to the races with my using, because I started, probably right after that, I started, now I know this club usually likes to talk only about alcoholism, but my alcoholism comes hand in hand with drugs also, because it was like I had a glass in one hand and my hand out in the other. I did everything all the time. And the minute I started to drink, people would hand me things, I would take them, and I just, you know, I never knew what was going to happen to me. And that was the hardest part, was that I never knew what was going to happen to me. And just before, Shelley asked me, are we going to talk about the married men? And my husband's sitting right over there. And, I woke up with strangers all the time. You know, that was what happened to me. I got drunk, went to the bar, got drunk, did other things, and then I ended up going home with strangers. And then that was my life for a very long time. And I was able to hold it together, though. That was my denial. My denial was that I was able to go to college. I was able to graduate from college. I was able to get jobs. And I would be like a weekend warrior and get, you know, shit-faced drunk every weekend. And nothing ever changed. And I had no ability to stand up for myself. I didn't know how to take care of myself. I was a child. I came in here at 34 years old, 33 and three quarters. And I did not know how to be a grown-up. I learned how to grow up in this program. I grew up here. So basically, that's what I did all the time. I went to college. I ended up at parties. And if I was with nice people, then things were okay. If I was with strangers, things were not okay. And I had three times that I actually came close to death, but it didn't stop me. One of them was, I was at a party and there was grain alcohol and it was punch, and I took the punch, and then somebody handed me some pills and I took them, and I ended up in the hospital. It was Thorazine, and I ended up having, I'm allergic to it, so I had, it was really bad. And so, and the ER nurse knew right away what was wrong with me. So that was one. The other was, I had friends, I got so shit-faced drunk that they left me in the car when they went to go see Hailei in Miami. So I went to the University of Miami. They left me in the car. I got up an hour later and started walking around Lejeune Avenue. And I don't know if you guys, anybody knows what that's. So not the place for a little 20-year-old girl to be walking around. And so by the grace of God, a cab driver saw me falling down drunk on the street, picked me up, took me to a place to get sober, gave me coffee, drove me back to my car in Fort Lauderdale, and followed me back to the University of Miami to make sure I got home safe. So that was a little God thing there. And the last time I almost died, I was in Mexico, and it was my 29th birthday, and I thought, I'm going to do 29 shots of tequila for my 29th birthday. And so, thank God, I think I made it to 5. I don't remember how many when I stopped counting, because I would drink and then black out, and then things, you know. So I woke up the next morning, I don't know how, but I was in the bed on the place that I was, a Club Med that I was there. I was in my pajamas, so somebody dressed me. I don't know what happened the whole night, but the next morning I woke up completely like comatose.
I sat under a tree the whole day, and I couldn't even move my eyeballs. And had I done 29 shots of tequila, I would not be standing here tonight because I would have had alcohol poisoning and I would have died. So I came close all those three times. Do you think it made me stop? Hell no. That's what I would say, you know, are these extravagant promises? Instead of saying hell, it is not, I always say hell no. So I did not stop. I kept going and going. I went to work. I changed jobs. I changed states. I lived in New York for a little while. Then I went back to Florida. Then I came to Atlanta. And nothing changed. My life was exactly the same all the time. And I thought, okay, I got to get out of Atlanta. There's just too many rednecks here. I got to get out of here. So I'm going to move back to Florida. And I go to Florida, and one of my closest friends that I met when she was 2 years old at the ice cream truck, and she started using before me, and she was much worse than me, which is why I was able to stay out there so long, is that she came to see me, and she was wearing a white blouse and white pants, and she had dyed her hair blonde, and she just looked fabulous, and I wanted to know what happened because she was so bad. And I knew she went to some kind of treatment thing. I really never knew what it was, but she said she was going to a women's meeting. Did I want to come? I said, sure. Okay. So I came to this meeting, had no idea that I was going to an AA meeting. I thought she was being civic-minded, going to women's meetings. I didn't even know. And then I went to this meeting, and there was this woman. And in Florida, what they do is they share their story for 30 minutes, and then they open it up to the group. So they did that, and this woman basically told my story, and I realized my life was not changing. I was not growing because I was staying in the same place doing the same thing over and over and over again and expecting different results, and nothing ever changed because I was getting drunk all the time. I was, like I said, I was waking up with strangers. I never went out with a man that was available. I always, you know, I went for the married guys. I was just, you know, it was really terrible, and, you know, that's what I did. So anyway, so she took me to this meeting, and I realized maybe I'll try these meetings. I still was not convinced that I was an alcoholic. And actually, I may have been toying with the fact that I was an alcoholic, but I didn't feel like I was powerless over alcohol because I was not powerless over anything. I could will myself to get to work even though I was drunk the night before. I could will myself to, you know, get decent grades to get out of college. I was able to... I could will myself to go to the gym and work out for an hour and a half after I was loaded on, you know, ups and downs or whatever. So I would do that. That was my denial. And so I realized that I had to do something. I just wasn't really convinced yet. So I came back to Atlanta thinking I was going to move. I went to my first meeting I went to was at West Paces Ferry Hospital. And I was there actually today getting physical therapy, today, same place across the hall. And I went to West Paces Ferry Hospital, and I heard people start to say things to me that were relatable. I started to say, ooh, I did that. Oh, I did that. You know, I started to feel like I could identify with people at these meetings. And the next meeting I went to was, this girl told me to go to this meeting at the Galano Club, and so I went there. And I had no idea, you know, because I was so naive at that time. Galano Club is primarily a gay club, and I'm not gay, and I didn't know, you know, I had no idea, but I didn't feel like I totally fit in, but everyone was very nice to me. And this woman named Bonnie gave me my big book, and so I thought, I can do this, I'll go again. And then I kept trying to find new meetings that I felt like were more comfortable for me. So I went over to a meeting thinking, you know, I was still working at the time, I had my little suit on for work, you know, I was able to hold my life together, which was amazing. But I went to this third meeting thinking it was in downtown, so it was going to be more business people. And I walked in there, and, like, everybody was straight out of prison. It was on McClendon Avenue because I didn't really know Atlanta too much. So I just didn't really know. But this guy came over to me, and he said, you are comparing your outsides to everybody else's outsides. He said, and that's not going to work. So he told me, go over to the Triangle Club, and maybe you'll feel a little more comfortable there. And I did. And I went there, and my first sponsor that I picked her because I liked her dress. That was the reason. That lasted about a month. And, I had no idea what to do. And I still was really not convinced that I was powerless over alcohol. I still did not take the second step. It took me 2 years to take step two before I finally realized that I came to believe that there is a power, and it wasn't me, and that power could help me to live my life sober. And I just kept coming back to meetings, and I wasn't really working the steps, but I was going to meetings. We were going to Shoney's every night after the meetings and, you know, eating greasy hamburgers. And I started to meet people and friends, and I came out of my shell, because my last couple of months of using, I would go to work every day, and I couldn't wait to get home. And I would blast the radio. There was a song on around in the 80s by Loverboy, "Everybody's Working for the Weekend." Okay, so I would sing that at the top of my lungs, thinking, the weekend. You know, you would think that's what we're going to do, something fun. And what I did on the weekend was I sat in my house, my apartment, with my cats, and I drank box wine and smoked weed. That's what I did. And that was my excitement, because my life was just miserable towards the end. So everything was changing as I got sober and I started going to these meetings, and I started to feel like I could be part of people again. And it was a nice way to make some changes in my life. And I really didn't start working the steps right away. I had a number of different sponsors. This is a good thing too. Not everybody, when you get a sponsor, you know, we all think like we have to be there forever. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't work. That's fine. If somebody wants me as a sponsor and I work for them, great. If I don't, there's other people out there. We carry the message to everyone, and it's not a relationship that you have to lock yourself into for the rest of your life. So if your sponsor's not working, you can make those changes. But I didn't know how to do that. I didn't know how to set boundaries. I didn't know how to ask questions. You know, in college, I came home to my mother and I said, I want to change my major to accounting. And she said, no, you can't. And I said, oh, okay. Because I didn't know how to say no. I didn't know how to stick up for myself. So that was the kind of person I was. And I learned from these sponsors that I had. I learned how to say, because in those days, the phones had wires on them. And like, I didn't know how to say, I have to get off the phone because I have to go to the bathroom. So I didn't know how to do that kind of stuff. So, that was the way I was at the time. So I learned over time with my different sponsors that I could speak, that I had a voice and I could speak up. And I now have that voice. And what I said before about what drives my sobriety today is I speak my truth, and I set my boundaries when I need to set them, kindly, nicely, but I don't get walked over anymore. And I don't let people walk all over me. So that was, they say we're the piece of shit that the earth revolves around, and we're doormats. And I'm no longer that. I learned how to do that in sobriety. So I had all these different sponsors. The sponsor I have now is the sponsor I met at the ice cream truck when I was 2 years old, my friend Leslie. And I picked her because she knows me so well, and she gets to the bottom of everything very quickly. I had once done a fourth and a fifth step on my daughter, and she's the one who told me that my daughter's life is none of my business. And I didn't like that very much. But the truth is, since I embraced that my daughter's life is none of my business, our relationship has gotten so much better. So what sobriety's like in now? So I got sober. I had friends. I met my husband. Early, well, we thought we knew everything. I was 2 years sober and he was 1 year sober, and we decided to get married. So, which I don't recommend right away. We moved in with each other right away, and we were totally not ready for anything. So we ended up calling off our wedding, with the invitations out the door, because our families were so fucked up. I mean, they kind of ruined our wedding. And so, so we called the wedding off. I had to come into the meeting crying to everybody that, you know, the invitations were out the door. We weren't getting married. But I did say to him, we're either in therapy tomorrow or this is over. So we were in therapy the next day. So we started to do that. And what we ended up saying to our parents when we got married 8 months later, we said, we're getting married next Saturday night. Want to come? That's what we did. So we learned about ourselves, and we did that all those years ago. He's my best friend and my best ally, and he supports me and loves me. And in the winter, he warms my car up for me before I get in it. And so, you know, he's a good guy. So, and I never would have been able to meet somebody I couldn't have had a relationship that lasted 33 years. I couldn't have been a wife with the way I was drinking and drugging. There's not a possibility. So the things in our lives that happened. The next thing that happened, we wanted, of course, to have a baby. And 5 in vitro fertilizations later, we had one child. Actually, she was number 2. I had got pregnant 2 times after her, but I was already 45 years old, and so it wasn't working. And so we were very blessed to get pregnant and have this little baby. And, of course, we wanted more because, you know, when you want, we're addicts, we want more. But God did for us what we couldn't do for ourselves, because our daughter's name is Miranda, and we call her Demanda, because she was not an easy kid. She was not bad. She never really got in trouble with drugs and alcohol. She still hasn't shown that yet, although she's got some isms. But I would never have learned how to be a mother. And I also had the rageaholic mother in me from my mother. And once I remember, my daughter and I got into it when she was younger, she was about 4, 5, or 6. And she had these love beads on her door. And I grabbed them and I pulled them and they went flying all over the place. And I felt so bad that I was this raging, crazy mother. And I told my friend and she said, "You're human." Because human mothers, you know, sometimes we lose our patience, we lose our temper. And so I was able to repair that with my child. I got a new set of love beads and hung them up. Actually, Mark hung them up. So we did that. But she was not easy, but I took my program into my life. And so we were able to raise this child she never saw us drink, both of us. She comes into our house and there's a big bowl of fruit on the table. So if you offer her an Oreo cookie or an apple, she'll take the apple because that's what she grew up with. So we modeled sober living to a child. And boy, does it make a difference. I mean, not everybody's kids turn out okay. I mean, we are very blessed about that. She's actually, she was Demanda. She's an attorney now. So, that's wonderful. But in addition to that, some of the other challenges I had, I lost both my parents. So, my mom got something called PSP. She got sick and she died very young, 69 years old. She died early. And so I had not really forgiven her, for the upbringing that I had, but the program enabled me to move past that. And then finally, there was a girl who was going to come tonight. She couldn't come tonight. She just texted me before. She always says in the meetings that hurt people hurt people. And that put voice to what my relationship with my mother was, which is that my mother was broken. She was hurt. She wasn't mean. I thought she was mean. I thought she did everything to hurt me. And what it made me do is it put voice to the forgiveness that I needed to have to move past it so that I could love my mother again. And I heard another woman in the meeting say that she has a great relationship with her mother, and her mother's been dead for 20 years. And so my mother's been dead for over 20 years, and I have a great relationship with her today. Because the relationship continues, even though we lose those people in their physical sense in our life. But I was able to grieve her loss. I miss my father all the time. He was somebody I was very, very close with. We had our difficulties when my mom got sick because we didn't agree on her treatment and all that. But so I was able to go through that and stay sober. I didn't drink. I didn't drink over the 5, you know, all of those in vitro fertilizations. I didn't drink over being a mother of a young child. God, was that hard. Nobody told me how hard that was going to be a mother of an infant and then a toddler and then a 5-year-old and an 8-year-old, you know, one that was very willful. And had to deal with that. So I had people, sponsors, women who came before me who were mothers and who were wives and who could show me the ropes and show me what to do. And I didn't have to drink. And so that was the best. So I had that. And then one of the other adversity things I went through, in 2015, I got diagnosed with breast cancer. And the very first thing I did was pick up the phone and call my friend Missy, who had the exact same breast cancer. She's in the program too. She had the exact same one 2 years or 3 years before me. And I did every single thing she told me to do. So what I've learned in here too is I learned how to take direction. She told me what to do. I did it. No argument, no expression, you know, nothing. I went to every doctor she went to, and I was very lucky that I only needed radiation and not chemo. And I'm now 8 years out. And, yeah, so... I didn't tell you this, Mark, but I ordered a pair of hot pink corduroy jeans today online for Breast Cancer Awareness Month. So that's an outside issue, but I just... So anyway, I got through that. And, you know, some hard things around that, too, is our daughter was in her first year of college, and I didn't tell her about my diagnosis because I wanted her to go back to school. And she did, and then I told her about it after the surgery, and she is still mad at me for that 8 years later. She is still so angry about that, and you know what? I know I did the right thing. And if she's mad at me, what people think of me is none of my business, including my child. Because I had another friend who had a brain tumor, and she let her daughter come home from school, and her daughter's never been the same since. So I think whether I made the it wasn't the perfect decision. Whatever decision I made was the right decision because I had my higher power with me. So we got through that, and that was another thing we got through. What else? Some of the other things. I've had so many trials in sobriety that I've had to go through. And what I do is I take it to the meetings. You know, I work the steps. I sponsor 10 women. That's why it's really hard because when they say, does anybody want to be a sponsor, I have to sit on my hands. Because I really do want to, I want to help more people. So what I try to do now is if you need a sponsor, I will tell, I'll try to help you find a sponsor. Because I don't have, I do have time, I'm kind of semi-retired. But I will help people find sponsors. Because it's the key to the success of this program is, you know, is come to meetings, read the big book, do the steps, sponsor people, get a sponsor. All of those things, if I do those things, then nothing else matters because everything is going to be, you know, I'm going to be in sober living mentality by doing that. And so that's what I do. I try to help people with that. And, you know, some other things have come down that are difficult. One of them I had just mentioned, I was in physical therapy this morning. So I had been jumping around doing high impact aerobics for 45 years because, you know, I'm an addict. So it's like if one day a workout is good, 6 days is even better. So, and I was jumping around to the point where, and I have arthritis in my back, and it's really painful. And so the way I was treating my arthritis was to jump around and do high-impact aerobics, and then my foot gave out. And so I had to grieve the loss of Zumba, and that was really, really hard. So I went through all stages of grief, bargaining, all that other stuff. And I had to find other things to do. And I said once in a meeting that if one more other person told me to do yoga, I was going to punch them in the face. Because I am a cardio queen. I need cardiovascular. So I'm swimming one day a week, which, you know, I'm doing other things that I'm doing to, but again, I had to take this to my meetings because this was devastating for me. I mean, my whole 45 years I've been working out. That was my denial first. And now it's how I get rid of all of the anxiety, because I still have the anxiety. And my anxiety sister is sitting over there in the room too with me. Yeah. You know, I have all this anxiety and I can't and I don't want to and I don't need to use anymore. I don't want to drink it away. I used to want to get my feelings, you know, to squash those feelings. And I thought when I got sober, anxiety was going to go away, and it has not. So from the standpoint of once we get sober, we still are the same. I'm the same person. I'm just a person who works this program. And it, because I work this program, my life is better in every aspect. So I had to find other things to do. And it's not easy. You know, like going through difficulty is not an easy thing to do, but we don't need to drink. And the way I treat it today, because I have, you know, like I said, I've been sober a lot longer in my life than I was drunk at this point. And I get up every morning, people who know me know this, three things I'm grateful for every morning. Gratitude is probably the best tool that I can possibly imagine. It changes my perspective. It sets the tone for the day. I listen a lot. I listen to what you all have to say because everyone in here has something to say that's going to touch me. Everyone in here can be a teacher. I have to remain teachable, and I've learned to do that also. And I don't want to. You know, I'm a control freak. I mean, my husband will tell you I am a control freak. I love to make lists and get things done. I'm very, even in my days of using, I was somebody who got things done, and that was why I stayed out there so long. So I need that gratitude to ground me and to have me face the day and to help me get through whatever I'm going to do. And I have to bring my higher power into my life every day. And, you know, my higher power is, some people have a higher power that's a deity. Some people is a group of drunks. Some people it's a, you know, good orderly direction. My higher power sometimes to me is, it's a zip line. I connect up to this power that is not me, that is not my ego. Because when I'm in my ego and I'm in control and I'm making, you know, I'm calling the shots and running the decisions, my life is not as good as when I find acceptance. Because that's the other piece of this recovery that works so well, is that I must every day get to a point where I can say, I have acceptance. And yet last night I went to a meeting. I always hear something that's good. This guy was saying he had 90 days. He picked up his 90-day chip, and he said that he let them. So when things go to the point where I want to tell somebody else what to do or I don't like what they're doing, let them. Let them be. Just let them. And so I thought that was great last night for me, too, because I still need to learn. Every day I have to open my book, you know, open my page, and be teachable because I could very easily drink again. You know, the one thing I tell people all the time, my sponsees, like one person told me I had a drinking dream, it was so bad. I like my drinking dreams because what it tells me is I still need to be here. Because it would be very easy, you know, when things get rough or when things are not getting rough, for me to walk down the aisle in Costco because they always put the alcohol right in front of me, no matter how many times they change it, I'm always walking down that aisle. So it would not be difficult for me. If I stopped going to meetings and I stopped working these steps, it would be very easy for me to give in and give up. And the way I remain sober is to be vigilant about what this program tells me I have to do. And, you know, service is extremely important. I'm always trying to make connections with people to help out. And, you know, basically, I'm trying to think if there's anything else I left out. But my, you know, my drunk log was, it was there. What happened was I had enough being the way it was for so long and without any changes. And I've learned to be a grown-up. I grew up in here. I was not a grown-up at age 34. I was a child, a driveling, frightened, doormat. And I am now a good friend, a good wife, I hope, a good mother, and I'm soon to be a good mother-in-law because our daughter got engaged a couple of weeks ago. And so, yeah, we've had a lot of joy. And I think if we embrace this program, if we, you know, if that's what we do and we take it all in and we work it every day, the joy will come. And the difficulties will still be there. You know, I'm always, because now what I've had to embrace is aging and sobriety. So here's the new thing. So I remember when I came in, all the ladies that were old wore polyester and had blue hair. And now we don't wear polyester anymore. So, I mean, I don't know unless this is. But we, you know, I'm now one of the elderly women in the program. And so I hope that what I can do is reach out to people and say, you can do this. This is simple. It's not easy. It has never been easy. Life is not easy. But this is a simple program. It's very basic. You know, it's just, you know, don't drink, come to meetings, trust God, clean house, help others. Those three things, if we do that all the time, did I say four things? Okay. Anyway, see, I still have to be corrected by my friends. But, you know, that's what we do in here. We support each other. We help each other. And we don't need to alter the mood anymore. We don't need to squash the feelings anymore. We learn how to speak what we have to say. Those are the things that we can do. And we make good friends. I see a lot of my, I have a lot of my posse out here today, which is really nice for me. Yeah. My posse of women. And I go to a lot of women's meetings. My husband goes to a men's meeting. So it's really helpful because it's less threatening, I think, to go to a meeting where it's relatable. It becomes relatable. So I go to a lot of women's meetings and I do some mixed meetings. A couple of years ago, we started a meeting on Sunday. It's called the Chabad, the Beltline meeting at the Chabad house down on the Beltline. So if you haven't been to it, it's at 5 o'clock on Sunday. And this is another thing. I loved it. We started it with about 5 people. It's now about 50. A couple of years after COVID, my friend Beth told me, you need to start that Tuesday women's meeting back up again. And because we had a Tuesday meeting that we used to meet before COVID. And every week it was like 3 people. I was just getting so frustrated. I was finding discussion leaders and getting more and more frustrated every week. And then finally I said, okay, I'm going to put around a sheet. Everybody's going to take a month and find the discussion leaders for the month. And once I let go of it, the meeting took off. So that's what I learned too, is once I let something out in the universe will take care. And that meeting is now 15 women in that meeting on a regular basis. And at the end of this year, I've been the annual chair. So I found 12 monthlies. I will give that job up because it's also our job to let other people take that service position. It's really important to let go of our service positions because we do them to be of service, but when we're denying somebody else the ability to do their service if we take it too long. We are not in control of this organization. It's been around for, is it 83 or 85 years? 80 years, this organization. And the reason why it works so well is because our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. And because of that, because of the traditions, this organization is just, it's out there in the world. I've been to meetings in the Cayman Islands. I was in a meeting in Florence, Italy. We've been to meetings all over the place. And this is a miracle. I mean, it's so divinely inspired that, I still can't believe that I'm lucky enough to be part of this. And I really appreciate everybody, listening and being part of this tonight. And thank you so much. I think I'm a little early, but we can open it up. Does anybody want to share anything? Or, because we're about 15 minutes early. Anybody have anything? Oh, yes. Yes. am I excited to look forward to grandchildren? I am, but what I've learned is my expectations, I've got to breathe trust in, breathe expectations out. Our daughter is 29, and she doesn't want to get married for a year and a half. They'll be over 30. I pray to God she doesn't have fertility issues like I did, but it's not in my hands. So when they come, if they come, I promised myself that I would not be bride momzilla. I promise because my parents and his parents ruined our wedding. I won't do that. I learned that in here. My child's life is none of my business. I mind my own business as much as I can. So if they come, I will be as wonderful as I could possibly be. I hope and pray that I still have the energy to be jumping around and doing what I have to do. I pray for the physical fitness to be a grandmother, but yes, thank you. Yeah, so she wanted to know if I did my alcohol and drugs to numb my pain and to fill the hole, and I did. I was deficient. You know, I was raised to be deficient, and so I didn't have the tools, and I didn't know what to do, and so I drank, and I did drugs to be relaxed, first to be relaxed. Then I got so relaxed, I had no control, and I didn't know what was going to happen. So I think that's, you know, that's what happened is I was seeking and searching. I'm still seeking and searching. I just know that my answer today is the program and not alcohol. Okay, that's a good question too, because I am a meditator. I didn't think I could do that. I pray all the time. I prayed almost the day today. I do 30-minute meditations almost every day. I have a meditation app on my phone. I sit in a gravity chair because it makes me feel like I'm lifted. And I meditate and I hear my answers. Praying to me is talking and meditating is listening. And I do that. I love what meditation gives me. It fills me and it is an integral part of my sobriety today. So yes, thank you. I mean, Stanley, okay, I think I know who he is, but, he's a preacher, right? He's on the internet? Okay, I think I've heard about him, and I think he, you know, I think what we do is we learn how to embrace God in our lives, no matter what religion we are. And what I love about AA is that we can be all different religions in here. We don't have an outside issue. We our common bond and our common solution is Alcoholics Anonymous. We're all alcoholics. We are, you know, we don't have this separation of religions. But you know, what was nice for me is I would come into all these church basements with Jesus on the wall, and I'm Jewish, so it was interesting for me to embrace that. So, but we're all, you know, we're all alcoholics, and so that's what we have in common. So I want, that's our common bond and solution. Yeah, that's true. He was. And the Last Supper was a Passover Seder. Well, thank you very much for your time. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ms. Karen. Thank you for sharing your experience, strength, and hope. And boy, I can relate, minus the aerobics.
I'm Greg. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Greg.
We give away chips to count your sobriety time. Anybody want to pick up the white chips? Give us the button. Pick up the white.
White chips. Tell them 20 people. Ooh, congratulations. Ooh, all right, girls.
All right, anybody for 30 days? Nights and weekends included? What's this? You got 2 months? 60 days. Anybody for 60 days? 90 days. Anybody got 6 months? We got green for 9 months. We got a year? Year of multiple, or a year?
Congratulations. All right, Maren. How'd you do it, girl?
I got a competent sponsor. By competent, I mean, she hurt my feelings for 2 years.
Probably still does.
Still hurts my feelings. But I mean, she's doing a good job. She's taking me through the steps. She calls me on my shit. I stop manipulating everything. Stop lying. I sponsor women.
Yeah. Can I say something? Okay, well, first to take you too. I'd known Maren. I met Maren 2 years ago when I came into this room, and she was always sitting up front listening to her sponsor, and I admired her so much. She's never said no to anything that was asked of her. Always sitting up front, being a chair for Friday night last call. And I always looked up to Maren, and here she is, still 2 years.
And she runs the sound system here.
Oh, and she runs the sound system here, guys. Happy 2 years. See, she only acts shy. She ain't. Oh! Woo!
So, my name is Richard, and I'm a grateful alcoholic.
Richard!
19 years ago, I thought my life was over. I didn't come here. I got driven here in a van. Some of you may be familiar with that. The buildings are still up the street, off the extension there. But I was wrong. My life wasn't over. It had just started. All I kept doing for many, many years, just like we're going to say tonight, keep coming back. It works. If you work. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
And one last chance at the white one. All right, let's have a hand for the chips we hold.
Thank you, Greg. Thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
Was the last thing I wanted to do. There ain't no denying the pain you put me through. I thought I knew you so well. Guess I have to blame myself for letting you burn me till I was head down, hell bound. Digging that hole in my soul, got tired, wound up, burned out. Devil turned a good girl into a liar. I didn't. here running from the fire. Sweet talking, heartbreaker, you had me believe that you love me, but you gave me one match in gasoline. It all happened so fast, nothing was left but ashes. I should have seen it coming, but I was head down, hellbound, digging that hole and my soul got tired, wound up, burned out. The devil turned a good girl into a liar. I didn't come here looking for the light. No, no, I came in here running from the fire. From the fire.